yet for some, the pursuit didn't end on Christmas Day. I find this so fascinating. Woke up Boxing Day morning, and as I normally do, I flipped on the radio after spending time with the Lord and taking that time and then just finding out what the day has ahead. And on the radio, those wee hours of Boxing Day morning, all they could talk about was the little cluster of busyness at the malls. I thought to myself, wow, Christmas is not done and these people are in hot pursuit. The day after Christmas in the early hours of the morning, maybe the same people complaining about getting up early any other weekday. Isn't that startling? And there they are up early, cutting the tape at the malls. Hot pursuit. That was, of course, the constant pursuit of Christmas that carried through. What about the returns? Some of you witnessed the Christmas returns, right? What was received back? Maybe the child, the grandchild that opened the present on Monday. That present was soon forgotten by Thursday. We know how that goes. Maybe that's been the reality for some adults pursuing so much at Christmas. Now the return, the gifts, the plans, maybe not delivering as you thought. All that was prepared for, all the energy, all the expectation, only now that hollow feeling. All of this and it's over, it's done. Now, as we've already said this morning, the prospect is only deep winter, payment plans, and January blues. That's what's ahead of us now. Compare it to what was promised. Think about this. Compare that to what was promised just a few weeks ago, right? What was promised? All of the garland and holly and presents and plans, everything, the expectation of what's to come. Now it's done, and it may seem like a cruel trick to many of us, the pursuit of the carrot at the end of the moving stick. And we realize that in our pursuit at Christmas and the returns that they yield, that Christmas, and we started this last week, may not be as it is often presented. That reality, of course, is what we began to look at a week ago today as we endeavored to strip away the clutter at Christmas. Remember, that's what we looked at. What is Christmas? What is Christmas? We looked at where a form of peace, goodwill, promise, and faith is offered every Christmas, is it not? In every ad, in every card, this is what's promised at Christmas time. But we asked the question, is it true? Is it true? And last week we looked at True Christmas. That first chapter open in front of you, Matthew 1, the simple arrival of the Christ child. In Matthew 1. And all the true peace between God and men, remember, that's true Christmas peace, that the God of the universe would have peace with his creation. True peace. All the true goodwill, the offer from God to man, the only gift, right? That's goodwill. That God would even be mindful of us to give us the gift of his Son. Then the true promise. Talked about all the empty promises at Christmas time last week. Remember that? We also talked about the true promise of God promising salvation through his Son and delivering on that promise. And then, of course, true faith, the only true and fitting response to God's offer to us. This week, as you look down at chapter 2, we continue in Matthew, and we will continue our examination of true Christmas. And we'll do so through the lens of some familiar and not so familiar faces. Last week it was Mary and Joseph. This week it will be through some wise men and one wicked king. To begin, let's just get into our passage. Let's get familiar with this text, Matthew 2. Look at verse 1 with me. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen, when it rose, went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. A stark contrast, did you see it, in that passage, in the individuals in that passage. A very stark contrast. And although their ends are very different, their means are the same. Each group is getting to where they need to get through worship. Through worship. And we'll look at that. As we continue our study of true Christmas this week, we'll see worship on full display in this passage. And specifically this morning, we're going to look at two bedrock truths of worship. Two bedrock truths. Let's look at the first one. Worship pursues. Worship pursues. We'll see that in the first half of our passage. Scan back to verse 1 with me. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. See that first phrase there, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. This gets us right back to that first Christmas. Remember last week we were in Bethlehem. Mary and Joseph, of course, are from Nazareth, but why did they end up in Bethlehem? Remember the census. The census, and of course Joseph being from the line of David, right, of Judah, has to go back to that city of Judah, Bethlehem, city of David, for the census. That's how they end up in Bethlehem in God's divine providence. And we looked at the birth last week, remember? Just as, God foretold, just as God promised. Well, we get a time marker here. Do you see it? Look at it. In the days of Herod the king. That's your time marker. And that name Herod, as you look at it, that's a very familiar name in the Gospels, is it not? Herod. And not because this Herod makes his way through Jesus' life. That's not why that name is familiar, no. This would be the Herod that's at the top of the chain. When you think about the family, the Herodian dynasty, this is the Herod at the top, the patriarch, if you will, of them all. This is the Herod the Great, who came to power roughly 40 years, give or take, before the birth of Christ. That's when this dynasty started. He was in power when Christ was born, but not much longer after that. That's very important. He was the one reigning at the time of Christ's birth, but very soon after Christ's birth, he died. He was truly a king of grandeur, Herod the Great, and he loved to build. He loved building projects. In fact, he loved them so much. You know the second temple, so you have the first temple that was built by Solomon. It's the first temple period. The second temple period begins with Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember when they come back, the captives come back, and they build that second temple. Well, that temple was just as majestic as Solomon's temple, but at the time of Herod, who loved to build, he wanted to reconstruct and expand that temple. So that's what Herod the Great did. And that's why when you get to John 2, Jesus makes that proclamation about the temple being torn down in 3 days and being built back up. And what do the Pharisees say? This temple, it's taken 46 years to construct this temple. Because that's what Herod was doing. He began that work and it was still going on. In fact, according to some studies, that work was still being done at the time of the temple's destruction in AD 70. That's the work Herod started. I mean, he just like opened it up for a long time. But that was Herod. That was King Herod. He loved grandeur. He loved visual spectacles of his power. And we're going to see that more even later. And one more thing to note about Herod the Great is you just think about who this king is. At his death, again, which happened very shortly after Christ was born, his kingdom was split in three ways. Three ways. The first piece went to Archelaus, and you'll see that name pop up in the Luke account at Christmas. Remember, Joseph didn't want to take his family back to Judea because Archelaus was reigning, and that is because Archelaus was extremely inept. He was the inept Herodian son, very much feared. In fact, he was so inept, Rome kicked him out, and you know who they replaced him with? You know this name, Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate. So that's Archelaus. That was one. The second was Herod Philip II. He'll pop up again. We'll revisit him with the John the Baptist account when we get there in Mark and a wife that he took. But he ruled north of Galilee, kind of out of that visual map you have of the Holy Land. And the third one's one you know very well, Herod Antipas. He ruled Galilee, the region that Jesus is in mostly. He is the one that put John the Baptist to death, and he is the one that Jesus stands before just before his crucifixion. So they're the three sons of Herod the Great. Again, that's important to note because this Herod is not the one that carries through, but he starts a dynasty where the legacy is felt throughout the Gospels. Again, those are Herod's sons. Birth account now, we're looking at Herod the Great, the father. Specifically, his life and reign. And it's so important because he exudes characteristics that really give us insight into worship. This man was worshiping something, very much so. And not just the great buildings, the buildings to get him to the end of true worship. And we look and we think about worship in this passage as it's contrasted with another. We go back to verse 1. Others that come to Herod. Behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. We're introduced now to wise men from the east. Now, a couple of things we need to mention right off the bat when we start talking about the wise men. First, the specific number of wise men is never given. You might have heard that said this Christmas season, and it is true. You will not find in the Bible three. Excuse me, you'll never find that. That traditional number of three, you say, well, why is it three? We three kings, three wise men. That's simply because three gifts are listed in verse 11. So tradition ascribes one gift to each man, but we don't know for sure. I mean, there could be anywhere, we know it's plural, anywhere from two to who knows how many. Secondly, the Bible calls them wise men, not necessarily kings. The Bible is explicit that they are wise men. There are other kings in this passage, one wicked, one good. But these men are not mentioned as kings. They're only noted in Matthew as wise men. In fact, the word there, if you look at it, wise men, that's a word you do know. It is magi. Magi. That's where we get the word magician and magic from. And why? Because magi were men of knowledge, even men of cosmic knowledge. It was dabbling in that bit of astronomy, right? And their knowledge of all things of the universe. The Magi, in fact, in origin, were a priestly tribe of sorts originating from Persia. That's their ancient roots. That would be modern-day Iran, if you're thinking about a map, that region, that's where they would be from. And that also is interesting because that's the region where Daniel is from. You know the book of Daniel, toward the end of the Old Testament? That's where Daniel and his friends were during the events of the book of Daniel. And most importantly, and here's the key with the Magi, in that Persian court, the Magi would have held the highest power and influence in that Persian court. That's how respected the Magi were, these wise men. Lots of influence, lots of power for a pagan nation. And that's interesting to consider as we again set the tone with these wise men. Note this, these men were the most revered in a pagan nation. You see that? The most revered in a pagan nation. And here they travel afar, no small journey, by the way, over 1,200 miles, a great distance on foot, revered in another nation, and here they travel to see Jesus. Leaving the high esteem, the prestige of familiar courts, to travel to another land to see a baby. Why? Look at verse 2. It says, where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. As mentioned, these wise men were likely from Persia, the region where Daniel was. We talked about that. And it's important, as in the book of Daniel, specifically when you get to Daniel chapter 9, you know what you get in Daniel 9? a very specific time prophecy of when the Messiah would come. I mean, that's a whole other message. In fact, that's a whole other series if we were to go into the book of Daniel and look at that. But this is what you need to know. The time prophecy in Daniel 9 takes you right to the first century when Christ was born. And anyone who took any time studying and learning and reading, any wise man, would know that. That's so key. These men were wise, and not just wise with knowledge, but true divine knowledge. True knowledge that allowed them to realize there was a prophecy of not just a king, the king. It made them realize this wisdom as wise men, that present comforts and esteem, and esteem in a familiar home court, consider that, is nothing, not important, compared to what they were to pursue. Very important. Even more astounding, look at the title in verse 2 that they give to the king. This is amazing. What do the wise men say? King of the Jews. King of the Jews. Not king of the Persians, not king of the world, but king of the Jews. Amazing. This king, at least in that title of another people, is one they pursued at great length. Not a Persian king, not a worldly king, king of the Jews, those Jews. As if he was their king. Do you see that? Their pursuit is as if it was their king. And why? Why are they pursuing this Jewish king? Look at the end of verse 2. What's the purpose of pursuit? To worship him. This king, their God, that they had read about, studied, think about how famous the events of this God and his people would be in Persia. The events of Daniel. They heard those exiled Jews among them serving that God that preserved Daniel's friends in the fiery furnace before Nebuchadnezzar. That's in Daniel 3. That God, that same God that brought the supernatural writing on the wall before Belshazzar. That's in Daniel 5. And that same God that preserved Daniel's life in the lion's den before Darius in Daniel 6. All of those events supernaturally, powerfully taking place in their homeland. They'd be very familiar with them. And these wise men would have been very, very acquainted with the work of this God. And now they arrive in Jerusalem to worship the arrival of that God to earth, the newborn king. That is pursued, and friends, that is worship. Just like we see with another in this account. Look at verse 3 with me. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. So consider the scene. These wise men show up in Jerusalem, and they're before King Herod, and before the reigning earthly king of these people. Isn't that interesting? Here they stand before so-called king of the Jews at that time, King Herod, right, over the Jewish people, in Jerusalem, no less. I mean, they're right at it before King Herod. These wise men say to Herod, in essence, we've come to worship your king. We've come to worship your king, your coming one. And what's Herod's response? Look at it. He is troubled. He is troubled. And like people, like king, right? And look, it says all Jerusalem is troubled. Isn't that fascinating? Like people, like king. The whole city, taking the king's cue, they're just troubled. They're troubled that someone would be coming to take Herod's place. Now, Herod's troubled response is troubling in itself, but it gets more upsetting. Look at verse 4. Then assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. Friends, don't miss that in verse 4. Do you see it? Here is the leader of the Jews in Jerusalem, and he needs a primer on the teaching of his own people. Do you see that? He needs a primer. He needs someone to get it right for him. For him. He has no clue of the ancient scriptures, but he is nervous, and he feels very threatened. And of course, those chief priests and scribes only tell Herod what he should already know. Look at verse 5. This is what Herod should know. They told him in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people,
Israel.
That is a prophecy straight from the Old Testament. That's taken from the book of Micah. It's in chapter 5, verse 2. It's one of the ancient prophecies of the Messiah, the promise from God on the birth of the Messiah, and a very specific prophecy giving the birth city of the Messiah. That's why it's such an important prophecy. And of course, one that would be important for those wise men who are traveling to see this newborn king. Very specific prophecy, but that's not all. Not just affecting Israel. This is where we dive. Let's dive back in to that ancient prophecy. You can mark this. You don't need to turn there. But if you expand that Micah prophecy, let me just read you Micah. That prophecy came from verse 2, chapter 5, verse 2. Listen to as we read through to verse 4. And he, still talking of this Messiah, shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And then listen to this. And they shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. Just amazing. Can you just imagine that prophecy and the implications of the expanse of that prophecy to the ends of the earth? You can imagine all that coming to bear on Herod, a ruler coming who will have power to the ends of the earth. This is scary stuff. A king born with that kind of power, power that I want, that I have. The thought of it to King Herod caused him to tremble. He's feeling the grip loosen. What is he to do in the wake of that? What is one to do who worships power and control? What is one to do when that happens? When power and control, the threat is there that it'll be wrestled away from you. What does one do when they feel that closing in? Well, Herod does what many of us do in a similar circumstance. He tightens the grip. Look at verse 7 in Matthew 2. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." All of a sudden, do you see this? All of a sudden, Herod is now interested in this king, this baby. All of a sudden, Herod is now interested in what God has to say. Notice he asked the wise men in verse 7, if I could paraphrase, it's like he's just saying, okay, wait a minute, tell me about that kid again. Now you got me. Now I'm in the headspace. Let me really know about this prophecy. You see that Herod is sitting up. And then the paranoid king sends them on errand. Do you see that in verse 8? Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too might come and worship him. Friends, we can't miss this, as this is where we so often just continue to read, because it sounds very noble, doesn't it? I mean, if you just heard that on its own, you would think, wow, that King Herod, just so noble. He wants to throw in his worship, but is that true? Is this just Herod playing catch-up? I mean, he's been a busy king, too busy to learn about these scriptures, and now he realizes, and now, okay, well, yes, I too want to worship. I've had a lot going on, but now that I get it, I want to worship too. Well, fast forward to verse 12 for our first clue that things aren't always as they seem. Look at verse 12. And being warned in a dream, so the wise men go and visit, and we'll look at this in a second, Jesus. And afterwards, verse 12, being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Why the warning? Well, verse 13 makes this very clear. Keep reading. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." It's all out there with what Herod's true intent is. Indeed, there is something very different about Herod's pursuit of this king. The wise men pursuing to worship, Herod pursuing to ruin. You see that? Amazing. And here is where we see the intersection of two pursuits. Equal in obsession, but very different in object. Do you see that? The wise men in pursuit in worship of the true king, the Christ. Herod in pursuit and worship of his kingdom, his power, himself. Notice, church, this is not simply a matter of one worshiping and the other not. Do you see that? This is not what's going on in this text. This is not just those wise men get it and they worship. I think so often we can relegate worship to just like it's a Christian word or a church word. It's not what it is here. Both Herod and the wise men are worshiping. Do you see that? And like all worship, when we worship, whatever you worship, you pursue. You pursue what you worship. We go after it. We follow hard after the things that our heart yearns for. Is that not true? What do they say? Your time, your talent, your treasure. Where you invest those things in, that's what you're going after hard. And for the wise men, this is obvious. I mean, they are just a living picture of pursuing Christ. Traveling far, far outside their comforts. But for Herod, this is also painfully obvious, is it not? Maybe geographically staying put, but rabid. Rabid in his worship of his own control and power. And the pursuit for nothing, nothing to take that away from him. Friends, what a picture of the pursuit of worship in these two. Stopping at nothing to bow down. Think about it, these wise men were relentless. They stopped at nothing. Herod, relentless, stops at nothing, both wanting to bow down, but very different altars. It's a reminder for us, each one of us here today, that we are all pursuing. Beloved, we are all pursuing something. We are all worshiping something this morning. And the question in a text like this must be asked, what is it? What is it? In the post-Christmas wake with the new year ahead, I ask you, what are you pursuing? So you think ahead to 2018, what is your pursuit? What are you going after next year? What is it that you will risk comfort for, risk ease for, to pursue? Or what will you not let go of comfort for, you will not let go of security for, to pursue? In fact, we can crystallize it in this one statement. Now, I just want you to consider this statement to yourself. Just think about this. I want you to fill in the blank. Just don't ask me to live without blank. Whatever you put in that blank, that's what you're worshiping. Just don't ask me to live without that. Anything else, God, but don't ask me to live without that, because I can't. Whatever fills that blank is what you worship. For Herod, it was control and power. For the wise men, it was Christ. Pursuing the newborn king with all their might. What a picture. Traveling afar. Let us not be fooled at Christmas. We too are in great pursuit of something. Listen, you don't need to be running. You don't need to be very mobile at all to be in hot pursuit of something. We too are worshiping something. It's not a matter of if, but what. But that's just one bedrock truth of worship. Let's look at the second in this passage. Worship returns. Worship doesn't just pursue, but worship returns. Let's look at the second half. Look at verse 9. After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. You know, the wise men listened to Herod, right? From verse 12, don't you get the sense, when you look at verse 12, you get the sense they had no reason to doubt his sincerity, right? The whole fact that they had to be warned not to tells you that they didn't doubt. They missed it. Here was this full worship of God, and they totally missed it, and they needed the angel to set them straight. So they head back out, following the star that has guided them thus far. And just a brief note on this star. I did so much reading this week on all of these natural explanations of the star. You know, it's just incredible, right? It's like what Dan walked us through with the virgin birth. I know. It's like Jesus walking on water. All these things, these rational, scientific, worldly reasons. Well, let me speculate on what this star was, beloved. God has always been a supernatural God. He has always worked supernaturally, and he will continue to. The issue isn't coming up with an explanation for what the Bible says. You know what the issue is? receiving what the Bible says. We're the problem, not science. We are the issue. That is a supernatural event. I mean, so many things, planets crossing, once in a millennium and events, blood moons, all this craziness. It's a supernatural movement of God at one of the most amazing times, the advent, the arrival of the Christ. I think if there was ever a time for supernatural work, that would be the time. You know, the precise reason why we can't understand these supernatural things is the answer. Because it's God, not us. Like the leper instantly healed, like the demon miraculously cast out. And if I can say this for those of us wrestling with doubts of these natural things, supposedly, like the very resurrection you place your faith in, the most supernatural of all events, do you believe it? The resurrection is true, how much more a moving star. And so it is with a moving star, a virgin birth, but this star supernaturally guiding, look at verse 9, straight to the place where the child was. Now, another fact to note, the text does not say to the manger. Do you see that? It doesn't say it guided them to the manger. It says the place. In fact, we're going to get an even more specific location in just a moment. And if the star first appeared at Christ's birth, we know at the very least, so track with me, at the very least, it would have taken a few weeks to get there from Persia. A few weeks. Remember, that's a long journey. It's on foot. Don't have planes or trains or cars or anything like that. And that's just a few weeks. It is possible it actually could have taken longer, even up to a year or even 2 years. You say, okay, well, wait a minute. Where are you getting that from? Look at verse 16. Verse 16, we're very familiar with this account of what Herod will do, but let's be reminded of the instructions he gives when he looks to destroy Christ. Look at the end of verse 16. All the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, and note this, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. You see that? So whatever's going on with our time references, we know it could be up to 2 years, the wise men, before they got there. Now listen, all of this, whether it's the amount of wise men or the timing of the wise men, it's not meant to blow apart your nativity scenes. Listen, we have wise men in our nativity scene and we are just fine with that. And there's three of them, and we're really good with that. That's not the intention here. But listen, what it is meant to do is affirm the effort. Do you see that? The point of this text is to affirm the effort, the distance, the time. That takes effort, right? As worship does. Again, this journey from the wise man and this response from Herod only affirm the pursuit of worship. And here it is, the lengths that we will go to worship the deep desires of our heart. That's the point. But here in this Christmas account, we see more than just pursuit, we see a return. Look at verse 10. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Just such a great verse. The wise men arrive, the fruit of their pursuit, do you see that, is there. The object of their worship is before them, and what's the return? Look at it, joy, exceedingly great joy. You know, this is one of those passages I just get excited about. There's so much emphasis in the original language. I mean, the Greek just explodes with adjectives and emphasis, and you try as you might to just bring that out. This is just unbelievable, exceeding, great joy. In other words, joy was abounding. This is no underwhelming reception. This was the king they worshiped, the Lord they passionately pursued, bringing great joy. And the returns continue in verse 11. Just amazing. Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Again, do you notice that? The affirmation that they're not in a stable. Where do they go? They go into the house. Go into the house. Very likely relocated to a house, still temporarily. Remember, they're from Nazareth. But right, those weaning years, the child, those early infant years back then, not as easy as it is now where we just have a bottle and we can just give the baby the bottle. There was a lot of care and effort in those first tender years of birth, so they needed to just relocate and be there. The infant wasn't ready for that great travel back up to Nazareth. And what's the response? So they come to the house, right, where the Christ child is. What's the response to seeing the baby? Now just consider, right? We've looked at this so much in Mark. The expectations of the Messiah. Here it is. They have all the prophecy, all that great, great prophecy. Here he is. You can just picture they're going to open the door and the Messiah's behind that door. They're going to open the door and all of a sudden, what do they see? A baby sitting in their mother's lap. And what do they say? Are you kidding me? We walked all this way for an infant? What do they say? I had no idea this. I mean, if I knew that this is what I came all the way, what do they do? Whose expectation is it? Theirs? Did the circumstance unfold the way they wanted it to? Was it what they thought the Messiah should be? Was it a Messiah of their own understanding? No, look at the text, friends. Look at the text. They fell down and they worshiped God for who he is on his terms, the Christ child, and can we say this, exactly as God had promised. And again, it begs the question, the issue is not with Christ. The issue is with us. Who do you want Christ to be? No, friends, they lock eyes with that baby and they fall on their face. And when they get up, they just keep on worshiping. Don't you love it? What a scene of these wise men. They don't get up and say, okay, what next? That was the proper fitting entry. No, what do? They get up and you know what they do? They open their treasure. They open their treasure. I just love this. Gold, I mean, gold speaks for itself. I don't care what era you're in, gold is gold. Precious, precious. Frankincense, so many of you, frankincense as it experiences a renaissance, an aromatic gum from the bark of a popular East Indian tree. So precious now. Very precious then, and myrrh, also a gum, but used more as a spice and a medicine, especially for embalming, right? We know from Mary and Martha, right, how precious those nards and embalming ointments were. Beloved, they didn't run to the dollar store to bring something to Jesus. They opened their treasures. They opened their treasures for Christ. For Christ. It's an amazing worship. All of those more than gifts, they were treasures offered to the newborn Messiah. And that is what the wise men brought. In fact, verse 11 makes clear that it is their treasure. Do you see the wording? Very precise. They opened up their treasures. Think about that. They took them with them. They didn't keep them closed. Their treasure chests weren't hidden back in Persia. They brought their treasure with them and offered them to the king. You leave your house today, and as you should, I'm not saying you shouldn't, you lock your door because you have treasures in your house. You go around to Christmas function, you don't bring all your treasures and your photos and your stuff. You lock them away and you keep them. They, friends, mark it, brought their treasure to Christ. They brought their treasure to Christ, their treasures to him. That's the return that these wise men received from their worship. And mark it, friends, worship always will give you a return. Always. For those like these wise men who worship Christ, the true king, look at the returns. True joy, true satisfaction, true contentment. Their hearts open, their treasures open. Worship of Christ means that opening your treasure here is nothing compared to the treasure that we have in Jesus Christ. Our salvation, our sustainer, as we sang this morning, our true hope in a dark world. Great joy, freedom with treasure, and one more return. Look at verse 12. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. I love this. They were warned. That's God's hand of protection, not only on his son, but on the wise men that seek Christ. Do you see that? That's protection on his people that worship him. God is with them. Who knows what Herod would have done? We have no idea. He could have just used them as a pawn, right? Maybe just kicked them out of the court, or he was willing to slaughter two-year-olds. We have no idea what Herod was willing to do, but God was protecting them. We do know that. And that is what worship returns for these wise men who, note this, worship Christ. Yet for others, like a certain earthly king in our passage, the returns of worship are far different. Far from satisfying, they only serve to expose an itch market that will never be scratched. We see this with Herod. They only reveal a wound that festers and grows, and market friends is never satisfied. For Herod, his returns were clear. Remember the warning in verse 12, right? All of a sudden, his attention he may have claimed before the wise men was for Christ. He's got all kinds of other intentions. His focus is all over the place. Here's why they need that warning in verse 12. Look at verse 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and he killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Friends, we need to grab the reality of that verse. What did Herod get in return for his worship? Fury, anger, and murder. That's the return for his worship. Control means so much to Herod. Power means so much to him. Lives, little lives, mean nothing. He is furious and he is angry. That's what Herod received for his worship. The threat of losing what he worships so much. And that's what Herod and those that worship anything but Christ receive in due kind for what they worship. Not so different today with our worship. Often misguided, is it not? For others, it's emptiness, disappointment, at unmet expectations, at dissatisfaction. For others, it's questions, it's doubt. Sometimes it's just bewilderment. Sometimes it's expressed in a little phrase, "Why, Lord? Why?" Treasures hoarded, control pursued, objects of worship never delivering. All the effort expended on worshiping everything else but Christ. And the returns match up because those things never satisfy, and mark this, they never protect. In fact, look what happened to Herod. Herod was not protected at all. He was furious and angry and very much exposed. And look what left to his own devices he did to all those children. Friends, it doesn't have to be little ones murdered. But there can be returns that we garner when we don't worship Christ and pursue other things. It can be us too if we're not careful. And quickly, the new year can be a hollow proposition of more of the same. Friends, we've noted so often before, and we need to in a text like this, on the cusp of a new year, we will worship. Do we see that? We were made to worship. Can't say this enough this morning. Worship is not a Christian thing. Worship is a humanity thing. We were made to worship. Every human being, every one of us in this room at this very moment has an altar worshiping something. We were made to worship. The question's not if, but what. And again, what are we pursuing? And more, here's the key as we move into 2018. Do we realize the returns we're gaining on that worship every day when we pursue and expend tremendous energy? Listen, you don't have to be moving at all to expend energy in worship and to receive return. You know, we consider this idea of worship, it's not just on the hearts of Christians, but on, as we've said, unbelievers too. Not too long ago, a famous atheist author made these comments. He was asked to speak at a commencement ceremony. He's asked to speak about worship. This is an atheist. This is an unbeliever. I want you to hear what he has to say about worship. I quote him directly. "The compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never feel like you have enough. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you of your own fear. Worship your intellect, and you will end up feeling like a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is this: they are unconscious. They are default settings. End quote. You know, just so much there, is it not? And you think, wow, from the mouth of an unbeliever who just nails worship, nails it. But the last part, loved ones, really sticks out, does it not? Listen to what he said. They are unconscious. Indeed, friends, we can have our worship on autopilot. And listen, I'm not talking about this morning, Sunday mornings, when you're singing and you realize, what am I even singing? I'm not talking about that autopilot. A very different autopilot. I mean every day with the things we truly worship, we truly pursue, and then we come to the end of another day, another week, another year, and we look ahead at another year with only empty returns of those insidious things. We can take our cue from these wise men, these true wise men. Think about their true worship. What did they worship? Who did they worship? Christ, and Christ alone. Nothing else compared to the riches of Jesus Christ. No distance, no treasure, nothing. They laid it all out there for Christ. And look at the return. And of course, I think if we could interview the wise men, it wouldn't be about getting those returns, right? We have to be careful in a text like this so we don't take that application. Oh, okay, preacher, I hear you, because I want joy in 2018, so let me try do this Christ thing. That's not the way it works. Christ, and recognizing who Christ is. Loved ones, the more and more we recognize who the Son of God is, again, as we study Mark, his treasures speak for themselves, and you realize more and more there's absolutely nothing on earth or in our own hearts that compares to knowing Jesus Christ. Friend, what did we talk about this morning? As people are sick and die around us, as the world gets darker and bleaker, as January looms, there is no hope in this world except Christ, the newborn King. And you live in light of the newborn King who has given you not just life there, but richness and joy. Listen, before we walk away all feeling discouraged, the wise men had great joy here. This is not some on the clouds thing. Beloved, you too can experience great, exceeding, abundant joy here in the middle of January when it's freezing. When the bills pile up, when you can't believe they said that about you, when the day didn't go the way that you wanted it to, you can have great, exceeding joy. Why? Is it just changing your expectation? Is it just next time I got to think that through better? Is it, well, I got to bring more to the table? No, beloved, this text on worship from these wise men, one thing, Christ. Saturate yourself in Christ in 2018 and let the returns flow. Jesus Christ is all you need. He saved you, Christian. Let him sustain you from year to year. Jesus Christ in him alone. I pray that is our heart's cry as we go into this new year, worshiping the newborn King. Let's pray.